from WBUR Boston and NPR. I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. In the city of Los Angeles, just 38% of murder cases with black male victims lead to an arrest. Los Angeles Times reporter Jill Leovi has witnessed the reasons why the criminal justice system lets so many black men die without finding a culprit, without finding justice. She's written it up in a powerful book called Ghetto Side. And it's not just L.A. This hour on Point, when no one gets punished for the murders of black men. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. We really want to hear from you today. Have you seen this in your neighborhood? Too many homicides that never get solved. Lives ended, families torn, and no one punished. Why does this happen? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Joining me now from Culver City, California, is Jill Leovi, reporter for the Los Angeles Times, founder of the Times Homicide Report, which tracks murders in L.A. Her new book is Ghetto Side, A True Story of Murder in America. You can link to an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. Jill Leovi, thank you very much for being here today.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me on.
We've heard you talking about the book, and we've read the reviews, everybody going about how powerful it is. Here I'm reading the New York Times, your greatest gift as a journalist, your ability to remain hard-headed while displaying an almost Tolstoyan level of human sympathy. And I read that in your book. We want to give listeners on our call-in show a chance to bring their own stories to the table, share with you what they've seen in their community, and get your response. Let me ask you something right off the bat. We read a lot of stories about violent crime being down in cities across the United States. Does that mean that all of this is less of an issue, Jill?
Well, it is down. It's fantastically down. And it's funny. The book is based on events in 2007 and 2008. And even in that period of time, a few years, things have changed greatly. The one thing I would say about the crime drop is that what I focus on, which is the disproportion of victimization, the notion that blacks tend to be about 5 to 8 times more likely to die from homicide than whites, and that's going back several decades now, has not changed a whole lot, that there's still a yawning gap in terms of risk that you see in the numbers, that it's much more likely that a young black man will die than just about anybody else in the society.
How can it be that the rates of bringing in a suspect are so low when the number of murders has been so high? What's the problem?
Well, it's super hard. I should preface this by saying that I think that it's getting a bit better. You'd expect that to some degree as crime rates go down. A lot of this is caseloads, and so caseloads become lighter when there's fewer murders. And I do think LAPD is posting some better numbers, and NYPD just posted some very high clearance rates.
When you say clearance rate, you mean arrests and murders?
Yes,
cases?
I'm sorry. The rate of clearing cases. In my book, I talk about sort of the difference between a clearance rate on paper, cases that actually did result in an arrest versus being closed in some other manner, and also conviction, which is what happens later when it goes to the court. So all of those are different numbers, very hard to track. The 38% in LA City that you cited is going back a couple decades. If you take a piece of the high crime years and afterwards. So, and the reason I go back in time is that matters on the ground. That's the number of potential killers living in your neighborhood.
Still trying to understand it. I mean, if you look back, I don't know what it is now, but 2008, I'm looking here, Chicago, 35% of homicides solved. New Orleans, 22%. Detroit, 21%. Now, other cities with much higher. Philadelphia, 75%. Denver, 92%. San Diego, 94%. But some of these, Chicago, New Orleans, Detroit, incredibly low.
So I think that what you're dealing with is a very particular context of high crime. And this is on many levels a difficult environment, difficult both outside police departments and within police departments. The impediments on the street in terms of investigating these cases are considerable. The chief impediment is getting witnesses to cooperate. And there's a feedback loop here because the more unsolved cases there are, the more impunity there is concentrated in an area, the more afraid people are, the more the ambient level of fear is heightened by the knowledge that there are violent operators around you who aren't being caught by the police. So the more unsolved cases there are, I think, the more difficult they are. It is for detectives to make progress on them. It's also, I think, difficult because this doesn't get a lot of focus. It's not really been a big part of our national conversation about policing and about violence in urban areas. Just this very material consideration: how are cases investigated? Are they solved? Are they effectively prosecuted?
You describe a police department where resources are very scarce for those who are tasked to do this work, where they're buying their own binders to keep track of what's going on in the case, where they don't have interrogation rooms, where they don't get much help, the homicide detectives from others in the force. It almost seems as though it's just not a priority, that it's backbenched.
Yeah, a lot of this goes back in time some. When I first started shadowing the detectives I talk about in Southeast Division in the LAPD in Watts, that was the early 2000s. And indeed, they were all sharing kind of a back room with patrol to do their interviews and buying their own tape recorders. I think there's some analogy with maybe what we think of inner city public school teachers going and buying their own supplies. You know, It goes with how we've talked about policing for several decades. We talk a lot about, especially in LA, the number of officers on patrol, saturation responses, things that have to do with the other function, the patrolling function of policing.
Rather than the follow-up once a crime has occurred, you mean?
Exactly, rather than the investigative function. And that translates to how the police department organizes itself, and how we ask it to organize itself. This is really a reflection of our priorities.
Are you saying that sort of broken windows policing, that is, keep track of the little things and the turnstile jumpers at the subway and all the rest to keep a sense of order in the community, that's in conflict with solving murders, which would also seem to be pretty disruptive to order?
I think it can be in conflict. This is very, very complex. The balances have to be drawn between one function and the other. But I do think that in terms of resource distribution in the LAPD, those things do tend to draw more resources. And I think that's directly because there's more public pressure on them and more demand for them and more attention given to them.
Is it all about leadership? Is it about mayors or police chiefs? I mean, Philadelphia in 06, only 56% of its murders were being solved. The mayor declared a crime emergency there, brought in a new police chief, and boom, they got up to 75% clearance. Is it just a matter of emphasis?
Well, I would say it's not just about emphasis, and this is parenthetical, but clearance rates are very crude and a little bit hard to track. I'm always not skeptical exactly, but I always want to dig deeper. I want to hear about clearance rates and find out exactly what's happening with those cases. Sometimes you see in the difference between police departments, for example, a high clearance rate will correspond to a low conviction rate.
So you have to just watch that stuff. Throw any name up there and say, well, we tried.
But the larger point that you're making, I was thinking about this a lot this week. You know, police departments, the people in management of present day, complex police departments like the LAPD, they are spinning dozens of plates. These departments are vast, complicated compromises between lots and lots of political interests, sort of this encrusted layer, successive layers of reform mandates that they have to follow. They are they are civilian controlled and they are bureaucratic and they're doing what's been asked of them. And you know, some of the things I talk about in Ghetto Side, which is about a detective struggling with exactly these impediments and coming across kind of the case of his career that he's trying to solve, it's beyond the leadership of police departments. In fact, if they were to do something so radical as some of the things I suggest in the book, it's really almost not appropriate. something bigger has to happen. We have to change the national conversation. There has to be a political constituency for this. There has to be a research agenda that's followed through on and some evidence-based practices.
What kind of suggestions?
None of that has happened yet.
Yeah, so. We'll look at that, changing the national conversation. But what kind of suggestions that you're putting out would look so radical?
I mean, I think it would start with an acceptance of this idea that actually reaction is very, very important.
And when there's a murder. When
there's a murder, when there's violence, mm-hmm. murders and assaults, I would say. And it sounds like such a simple thing to say, but, you know, I get questions about this. I was thinking about this. I did a Wall Street Journal piece, and that was one of the commenters straight away said, but isn't it better to prevent? And I think they were just honestly expressing a sentiment that's widespread, which is it seems better. It seems so much better to prevent. It seems like you want to stop a bullet in its tracks and keep it from hitting that victim. And it takes a lot of explaining to say, you know, what we're trying to create is lawfulness, to build law and to build the legitimacy of the state in places where there's no reason that it would have developed at this point because of our history. And so that makes this seemingly reactive function, seemingly cleaning up after the fact function, very, very important.
Jill Liovi went out. She says, she writes, I carried a police radio, went to crime scenes, talked up people I met on the street, and got to know police officers. I was watching the statistics unfold in real time. And they weren't pretty in the city of Los Angeles. So many unsolved murders. She's written up a very powerful, very intimate report of that in her new book, Ghetto Side, A True Story of Murder in America. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. Talking this summer about huge numbers of unsolved murders in South LA and the country's problem of no justice for black murder victims. We want to hear your stories, your experience. My guest is Jill Liovi. Her new book is getting a lot of attention. It is titled Ghetto Side. You can link to an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. She's a reporter for the Los Angeles Times, has spent a lot of time in the streets, in the police stations, watching what happens and what does not. She says the system's failure to catch killers in these cases has effectively made black lives cheap. In a season when we have heard a lot of hashtag Black Lives Matter, this is getting a lot of attention. And we've got questions for you. Have you seen this in your community? Tell us. And what is it like when a young black man is shot and then nothing? No trial, no conviction, no justice. Could there be justice? Will enough witnesses speak up? Is enough effort put into it? Police officers, detectives, we want to hear from you. Is this your beat? Why are arrest and conviction rates so low? Do you have what you need to do the job from your department, from your colleagues, from the community? And if there was more justice, would there be less murder? Let's go to Atlanta, Georgia. Titus is calling. Titus, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I appreciate the opportunity to be in your program. I've been a lifelong listener. I'm in my 50s. I've been listening for usually a quarter of a century.
That is amazing. What do you see, Titus?
Well, you know, I appreciate you guys having the topic and discussing it in terms of valuing black lives, because that's what that expression, that phrase really resonates with me. It is, as an African-American male, you know, I'm an immigrant. I came here at 9, and I grew up in middle-class white America. My experience is that our lives are absolutely not valued. You know, I think you cannot separate this issue, this issue from the history of this nation and the context, you know, of racism and social dynamics in America. Yeah, I think if you go off and discuss it in other ways, then, you know, it's just an academic discussion. But this is it's about the heart of America. That's what this is about. It is about the heart of America. Do black people, in particular black men, matter? We know the answer is no. As black people, no. I'm being very honest.
Okay.
100%. We know the answer is no. Our lives don't matter. But you guys have, speaking to, you know, not all of that, you know, America. I mean, there are many people who, you know, white people, European descent, who understand that black people, you know, matter. But there's a significant percentage, a significant part of the conscious mind of Americans who see black people as less insignificant and marginalize us in their thinking.
Titus, what do you take from that? Titus, let me ask you, do you think that if people actually cared about black lives more, to put it in that rubric, that that clearance rates, that arrest rates would be higher in the case of black murders?
Absolutely. Absolutely. This is the issue. It's not, and it's not just, you know, black murders. That's just one, amazing statistic that discloses it. It's all the other statistics at play. It's all the social issues at play. America has to look at its own heart. And I say not before people, before God, right? Because you got to be honest. And you got to come to terms with that, because this display, everyone knows it. Everyone knows it. The only people discussing it are, like, white Americans who discuss it. Everyone else knows it. The world sees it. Black people certainly know it.
Don't even have to talk about it. Titus, stand by. Jill, weigh in here. I mean, it leaves me wondering how you look at that. Titus says that your report on the lack of suspects and convictions in the murders of black men is kind of just a tell of something bigger, that Americans don't care about black lives, he says. And he says everybody knows that in his community. Do you see it that way, or do you see just a systemic problem within law enforcement that if you fixed it, would really cut down on this degrading, unsolved murder rate and be a kind of solution unto itself?
Well, I appreciate Ted's comments. A mix of all of it. I wanted to point out a couple things that are important that I think he said. One is the point about history. Absolutely. I could not agree more. In some ways, everything that we're talking about is about the history. And it's interesting, the Jim Crow memory is very recent in L.A. We had a very much later migration of blacks from the South to L.A. than some other cities in the mid part of the 20th century. And many people I meet in L.A. are either from the South or have family memories that are quite recent about that period. And if you think about Jim Crow just in the simplest terms, what is that about? It's about infirm law. And it's why it's a big clue that infirm law is I think, at the root of things. The other point that he makes, which is that this is a commonplace in black America, I absolutely agree with that, too. There's nothing very original that I say in Ghettocide that I didn't, as I say in the book, hear on the street three times a day when I was covering homicides in South Los Angeles. I have a point in the book where a woman who's pulled over in a traffic stop hollers at the police officer, "Why aren't you looking for the people out here who are really doing bad things, really doing something?" And I say that, there's no South LAPD South Bureau police officer who hasn't heard that comment over and over. This is absolutely a commonplace in the neighborhoods that I've covered. It just hasn't quite risen to the level of a national
conversation. But there's a kind of critique in what Titus is saying, in a way of your work, that look at the bigger picture. You're tightly focused around homicide and murder, and it's just part of a bigger landscape. And I wonder how you respond to that, or if you think this is so important in these communities that can be so densely African-American that you don't have infirm law and enforcement here, that if you fix this, you fix a lot.
Well, I think both things. I think that this history is very big and has had very far-reaching and complex results, and we'll be talking about it for generations in this country. But I also think that there is a material component to this, that it is a matter of defining the problem properly and actually marshaling a material response. And I think it's one of the reasons that we haven't dealt with black-on-black homicides in this country is there's sort of this sense that it's this, the famous phrase from the Moynihan Report, the tangle of pathologies, that it's so complex that it's all of these socioeconomic ills and who can get to the bottom of it. And part of the reason I focus on the narrative that I do in Ghettocide, which is the story of Detective John Skaggs investigating this particular murder and kind of taking you inside that, is to show that there are pieces to this. We can break this down and there are practical things that can be done. And it's not hopeless, because I do think that hopelessness is part of the reason that people turn away from it. I wanted to address, if I could, one more thing that Titus said, which is a little hard for me to articulate, but I think the language we've used for this is all wrong. A lot of the work I see done that relates to homicide is really aimed only at perpetrators, and the idea of sort of at-risk black males. Well, what is that? I prefer to talk about victims, about losses, about who we're losing. And I think his point is very well taken. This starts with saying, you know, these are men we can't afford to lose. We need them in society. We are losing 6,000 black men a year to homicide, and we want those men to live and thrive. We need them.
There's a kind of valuing in a very essential way right there. Titus, I really appreciate your call from Atlanta. I should say we invited on Detective John Skaggs, who's sort of the hero of your book, the guy who does it right, who just goes out and goes like gangbusters to try and solve these crimes. The LAPD denied him permission to come on, which was curious to us. How they responded to your book? Why do you think they wouldn't want John Skaggs? I mean, he's a hardworking detective by everything that you report. Why wouldn't they want him on the air?
Well, he's a working detective today. He has daily and professional duties to take into account. So
simple as that?
Not sure how they play. And I actually don't know, because my book was just released this week. And I have been dealing with its release. I haven't talked to a lot of people, and I don't think a lot of people locally have had a chance to read it.
I bet the LAPD has read plenty. Has read plenty. Neil in Detroit. Thanks for calling, Neil. You're on the air with Jill Leoby.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Well, I just wanted to say I'm actually a homicide investigator out here in
great
southeastern Michigan, including Detroit, another violent community, Inkster, and I've also worked in Flint and Pontiac. But I just wanted to say I heard you on a different show the other day, and I went out and bought your book. And from what I've read of it, it's right on the money from a homicide detective's perspective. And I just also wanted to say that I heard from your last caller, one of the big problems that we experience, and it's probably not news to anybody, but it's the most frustrating thing for us when we're conducting our investigations is the lack of cooperation from the neighborhoods. And a lot of times what we hear is, the phrase that we hear all the time is, it's in the streets. When we're talking to victims, right, victims' families, they'll tell us, this is in the streets and we'll take care of it ourselves. We don't need you guys. So, well, go ahead, Tom.
Well, just so that means they're saying to you, butt out. We don't want you to solve this?
Yes, exactly. That's family members. I mean, multi-generational response from across the spectrum. They'll tell us that it's in the streets. That's the phrase that we hear all the time, and I'm sure if any other investigators out there listening to it, they're probably nodding their head right now in agreement.
That is really interesting.
And
hey, Neil, let me hold that thought and come back to you on your other observation that Jill's right on the money in her description of why this happens. There's one piece right there. What else struck you as on the money when she describes why we don't have a better clearance rate on these murders of black men?
And she talks about the focus, and I haven't been able to put the book down. I bought it last night, and I wasn't able to put the book down. As a matter of fact, I brought it to work with me today because I was going to be in court, but I've only gotten a little way through it. But the lack of focus, maybe we're in the lack of resources that are put toward homicide investigations. I know my department is really good about it, but you see it in some other departments. I would say that maybe not a point of disagreement, but from my perspective, some of the proactive policing stuff that we do really does have an impact on shooting rates and homicide rates and violent crime. I just find that anecdotally that when we're out there doing proactive policing, I think some people would probably call it broken windows type policing.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
But that does seem to be effective from what I've seen.
Neil, I'm really glad for your call, and I'm sure Jill is to have a homicide officer outside Detroit there, deep in her book. I appreciate you joining us, Neil. Jill, what about this business of it's in the streets? That is, it's our community's problem. Police, back off. We'll deal with it.
Isn't that amazing? And it sounds exactly like L.A. We'll take care of business here. This is I talk about the term self-policing in my book, and it's something that I hear particularly from young men. We're going to police ourselves. We'll take care of it ourselves. It's great to pause and think about that. What on earth is going on? There's a couple things I would say about it. One of the things I find interesting about gang homicides in L.A. is they're what I would call semi-furtive. They're not entirely furtive crimes. There is some element of them that involves publicly declaring that we committed this murder. We're going to write it on the wall in graffiti.
There's because it's a display of turf or power.
It is. It has a function. It has an instrumental function. It is in its world. It is a way of exercising power, absolutely. And that tells you that there is a system of power. It tells you that there's an alternative order that sprung up in what I think is something of a vacuum of order. And I wanted to address something else mm-hmm. that Neil said, which is that interplay between proactive policing and investigations. In fact, in the story that I chronicle in Ghetto Side, the Detective John Skeggs, he's brought into this unsolved case, which is the death of a young black man who happens to be the son of a colleague.
And another police officer,
Another police officer, a very emotional case. And prior to his being brought in on the case, one of the big breaks in the case is essentially a stop-and-frisk caper. it's the finding of a weapon on a young man that turns out to be the murder weapon. He's not the mm-hmm. murderer. So this stuff is very, very complex. I think that there needs to be a larger conversation about what works in so-called proactive policing and what can be counterproductive, because for the people on the receiving end, that kind of policing, sort of stopping people, searching them, driving around, it can feel really like control. It can feel very oppressive and harassing in a place where you're trying to get people to cooperate with police. And where solving a homicide, I think that's more likely to feel like justice.
Well, let me ask you, because your whole book is
sort
of— You
need the two together.
Well, yeah, but your book is kind of a cry for more, better, more focused homicide follow-up here. Neil's calling in from Detroit and saying, people say it's in the streets, back out. Are there others that you talk to in these neighborhoods who say, no, we want more effective policing on the follow-up on these murders? Or in this era of Eric Garner and Ferguson and all the rest, you could imagine people saying, no, we don't want the cops in here. It's just too oppressive.
And it's amazing. Sometimes people say all of those things in the same sentence, the same person saying it. There are so many layers of paradox here. You have the sense that people will criticize the police in one breath and then plaintively, call for more police presence in the next. It's extremely fraught. But I think that one assumption that I tried to chip away at Ghetto Side is the idea that there's solidarity in these poor black neighborhoods. Just because people are low income and black and living in the same place doesn't mean they have anything in common with each other. And in fact, I almost have a sense that divisions in society are pushed down. These are very fractious places, and there are rival camps and people who are on different sides of these issues. And a great deal of conflict, and the police are right at the center of it.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point, and we're talking this hour about huge numbers of unsolved murders in South L.A. and the country's problem of no justice for black murder victims. Jill Leovi writes it up in her powerful new book, Ghetto Side, A True Story of Murder in America. She joins us today from Culver City, California. We're going to get some feedback from New York City in just a moment. Rick Jones stands by there. We've got so many callers lined up. Let me get a few here first. Byron in Tulsa, Oklahoma. What do you see, Byron?
Well, I think that there's I think there's a high degree of hypocrisy in the black community because when it comes to actually testifying and giving the police information, the community has this whole attitude about snitching. And this culture of don't snitch and not snitching has been perpetuated even more strongly by this hip-hop culture. As a community, we have to take responsibility for what goes on in our community and policing ourselves in terms of actually identifying those people who are doing wrong.
And why do you think people don't, Byron? Are they afraid to, or there's an anti-law enforcement attitude? Why?
No, it's not that they're afraid to. It is that culture that makes black people believe that if you testify against someone who is committing a crime, you are a snitch. And it is that underlying cultural ignorance that is pervasive throughout the community. And it's a very simple solution of if you see a crime, report that crime. If you are a criminal involved in it or in that crime, and you say something about your people, then you are a snitching. You are identifying a criminal act that you participated in. But the community doesn't understand that if you're a victim of a crime or a witness to a crime and you testify against it, that's just being responsible. That's just being responsible to your community.
Byron in Tulsa, Oklahoma, I appreciate your call. Jill, how do you respond?
Well, I think the attitudes can sometimes be a cover for the fear. I, of course, there's a whole range of people and a whole range of attitudes that are mm-hmm. implicated in this. I do think that there's a lot of unseen intimidation that goes on. I'll just give one example. This was actually a Hispanic witness woke up in the middle of the night after the suspects saw this person at the scene of the crime, and a group of men have surrounded the house, and they're systematically walking around in circles and banging hard on every window for a extended period.
And they know, she knows, they're out there, and that's a pretty clear message.
It's a message. It's not an assault. It's not the murder of a witness. I can't even remember in this case whether this was reported to the police, but I do hear from witnesses who have things happen to them and they don't report them to police. There's a lot of message sending and, fronting out and low-level violence that does occur, I think, to intimidate witnesses. We don't really have a handle on that. Now, you could argue that it's not that common and it's not enough to silence people en masse, but that's a tricky argument to make. I mean, how much assault is enough to sort of breed fear? I personally think a little bit of violence goes a very, very long way. It makes people very afraid, but even if you wanted to argue that this was attitudinal, I think if you have any amount of violence or intimidation happening against witnesses at all, that's problematic.
But clearly, the don't snitch thing is a big problem here. Karen in Omaha, Nebraska. Karen, you're on.
Hi, Tom. I haven't read the book or anything, but I just wanted to make a comment. My son, a young African-American, was being pulled over in a dark place and for speeding. He was in the wrong for speeding, but he didn't feel safe to just pull over. So he called 911 and tells them that, and I think that's correct procedure, that he's going to wait until he gets into a public spot to pull over.
In other words, he was afraid of the police being pulled over at night.
Right.
So how does that factor in here, Karen? You mean there's just not enough trust in the community to work with police officers to solve these crimes?
No, there isn't. There's not enough trust. And even though my son has never been, doesn't have a record, didn't have any outstanding warrant, he just didn't feel safe. And he did the right thing by calling ahead and saying, I'm just going to do this. Can you tell that officer? But the officer was still mad. He called in other officers, and then they were saying, throw the phone out the window. He didn't want to make any sudden moves, so he didn't want to do that and get shot 47 times because they thought he had a gun and not a phone.
Right.
or could say that he had a gun in there, or they thought he had one.
Yeah, yeah.
So they dragged him out and threw him on the ground. And now he has to go to court for resisting arrest. So I don't, you know, so yeah, it's a big thing about trust.
Oh, Karen,
about African American men. And I think, even though I haven't read the book, I just feel like, you know, we keep getting all these journalists and really Caucasian journalists that know nothing about, that really can't put themselves in our situations.
Karen, we've got it. I'm very grateful for your call. I think Jill's done the work to get kind of familiar, but still, you hear the story, how painful this is. What about distrust as a factor here? Karen's got this right in her lap right now with her son calling 911 because he's concerned about the police, and then you hear all the rest. It's hair-raising. What about this as a factor in the problem?
Well, yeah, legitimacy is everything, and it doesn't help, obviously. And I actually think that she's right about the point about vulnerability. When you are the person who feels vulnerable, when you're afraid for your physical well-being from the police or from crime, it's very hard for people who are not afraid to go there with you. And I think that, you know, it's almost impossible to talk across that barrier as well. And it's takes a minute to step back and remember what it feels like when you're afraid that somebody's going to hurt you. It changes everything. The trust is everything. One of the things I'm thinking as I hear her talk, I wish, you know, there's a lot of noise and sturm and drang. One of the things that I think would be very healthy about this on all sides, and I actually put this more on the police because we really have a era of kind of tightly controlled police communications.
Mm-hmm.
I would advocate a much more radical transparency where ordinary police officers can talk publicly about what they're thinking, about what these encounters are like for them, that we have a stage where the people who are on the receiving end of these encounters can talk about what they're seeing, how they're perceiving it, that it's all out there on the table because, for one thing, the possibilities of misunderstandings here are so dangerous for everybody.
Karen, we wish good luck to your son there in Omaha. That sounds like a pretty tough picture. One more call and we'll go to New York. Phil in Wahoo, Nebraska. Phil, you're on.
Hi, Tom. I would just like to point out that this is an issue that goes back many, many decades, and I personally experienced this as a daily news reporter in a city down in Texas. And that would have been in 1991. And there was a young black man who was recently released from prison, actually earlier that morning, was shot point blank in the head, and witnesses described a white male in a black pickup. When I picked up the crime beat in the morning, the following morning, I read about the incident, and I talked to the captain of detectives, and he told me the particulars. And I said, well, when are you going to go pick the guy up? And he just flatly said, well, the guy was a crack dealer, and he probably sold him bad drugs. We're not going to do anything with this. And nothing was ever done with it. So I've seen it happen.
Bad dude, forget it. We're not even going to get involved. Jill, did you find that level of callousness to murder in L.A.?
Well, those are many years ago, 1991, though, of course, very, very high crime year. I think that, you know, we have had a lot of reform and tinkering in our police departments, particularly our big police departments like LAPD, which has been through not one five-year run, but 2 5-year runs of a federal consent decree. That kind of thing, though, is that long tail of history is absolutely a part of this because I think there's a tendency for some people to say, well, that was the past, it's over now. But again, if you're on the receiving ends and things don't appear to have changed that much in terms of actual outcomes in the world, why should you view it any differently? I think there was absolutely a lot of dismissing of black-on-black crime in the past, maybe more in the South. I had a reporter I believe on the East Coast, maybe Baltimore, who I once talked to, who had worked in the 1950s. And he said that he saw things called natural causes that weren't that were actually homicides. And I've never been able to verify that, but I think the attitudes that he was describing are worth noting here. The idea that that these people who were considered marginal were not, their murders were not galvanizing.
Phil, I appreciate your call. Jill, stand by there in Culver City, California. Rick Jones joins us now from New York City, executive director, founding member, Neighborhood Defender Service of Harlem. They provide legal representation to residents of Harlem, a trial lawyer, a lecturer at Columbia Law School. Rick Jones, thank you very much for being with us today.
Hi, Tom.
You're in the middle of this in New York. Jill Leovi is getting a lot of attention with Ghetto Side, her book. She writes in there, the system's failure to catch killers has effectively made black lives cheap. What do you think about this focus on a failure to police murder in black communities, Rick?
Well, I think that, you know, and it's interesting. I've been listening to the show, and I think that many of your callers have hit really important aspects of this. I think that the last caller said that this is a long time in the making, and I think that he's right. Now we've got in this conversation has a very tight sort of focus. Our lens is very tightly focused on homicides and the failure to satisfactorily resolve them or put sufficient resources into them. But I think if we draw our lens back and we look, what we're really talking about here is sort of the tip of the iceberg, and there's this whole long history that sort of leads us to where we are now. You know, when you begin to, as we have done over the last 30, 40 years or more, to try to resolve social issues in our criminal justice system, you're going to eventually end up sort of where we are now with the problems we're talking about between police and communities of color, the lack of trust, the distrust. You know, we are now at a place where we have massive sort of over criminalization in our society. There are 14 million new arrests every year. We've got mass incarceration. We've got some 2.2 million people who will sleep tonight in a prison. That's equal to the population of Paris. Mm. We've got 70 million people in this country who are living with a conviction, and all the collateral damage that happens from having a conviction and an inability to get jobs or employment or education. You know, there are as many people living in this country with a conviction as is the entire population of France.
So, but what would you do with that, Rick? Jill says, let's get in there and crack down on murder in these communities. At least you give some stability to the residents of the community. You're saying law enforcement's the wrong way to go. What would your approach be?
Change the focus. We need to front load this. We talk about more blacks die from homicide and we can't afford to lose those African-American men, but we don't have to. If you put resources in the community at the front end so that people have the ability to get the help that they need on the front end, whether it's with education or housing or whatever other sort of social needs there might be in the community, we should take the focus away from trying to drop all of our societal problems at the doorstep of the criminal justice system and commuting these, you know, creating specialty courts and novelty courts and those kinds of things, and really focus on putting the resources in the community, in education, in housing, in employment, and getting people to work. And then you will see the dynamic immediately change. You know, it's interesting. Neil was a caller earlier, and he's in Southeast Michigan. I was born in Detroit. In the 60s, in the early 60s, and my grandparents lived in Inkster in the companion community to Westland. And he talked about it. He described it as a violent community, and he's a homicide detective there and all the violence. As a kid growing up in Westland and Inkster, Michigan, you know, I don't think I've ever known greater freedoms. This was a community when I was a child that was sort of the first generation of African Americans coming out of the South to get jobs in the automobile industry. Everybody in every house up and down my grandmother's block knew who I was. I was always safe. I could leave my bike out in the front yard overnight.
Because there was a healthy economy, you're saying, Rick.
Because there was a healthy economy, because there was employment, because people felt good about themselves, because people went to work, because there was trust. When you called the police back then, you thought somebody would come and they would treat you with respect. It was just a different mindset. And we need to go back and change our national mindset to one where there is a community of trust and not so much an adversarial community, an adversarial relationship with African-American communities, black communities, communities of color, and the police, which is where we've come now because of our intense focus on criminalizing everything.
Rick Jones with Neighborhood Defender Service of Harlem. Thank you very much, Rick. Thanks for being with us.
Absolutely.
Jill, enforce the law or go big and fix everything. Fix the economy, bring in education, housing, all the rest.
I'm not against spending for social needs, and there's certain things that make a huge difference. We had, you know, cuts to summer school for kids in L.A. In recent years, and you could really see the effect of that. You know, homicide death rates for black men in this country were actually very, very high in the 70s. And it's not something that we look at a lot. I think that this law enforcement solving crimes is part of a larger puzzle, obviously.
Jill Liobi, author of Ghetto Side. Thank you, Jill. This is On Point.